convictions for secondary burglary and attempted secondary murder. I'm going to address the second issue concerning the trial court's refusal of tendered instructions regarding lesser non-included offenses and rest on the brief with regard to the sufficiency claim on the secondary burglary issue. However, if the court has any questions, I'll be happy to try and answer those. With regard to the second issue, I wanted to address two things. One is the inadequacy of the instructions in light of the analysis provided by Trujillo. It's a due process analysis. I think, interestingly, a second point I wanted to talk about in that context is regarding the arguments of counsel. The Supreme Court makes some reference to the arguments of counsel in the trials at issue, and I'm going to comment about that with respect to prejudice. One of the key words in Trujillo, and is basically the essence of this due process claim, is giving the jury options. The due process claim requires that the jury be given the option to consider and resolve the defendant's culpability based upon the prosecution's theory of guilt, here attempted secondary murder, and the defendant's theory, which was comprised in the four lesser non-included offenses that he tendered at his second trial. In Mr. Martinez's case, the court rejected the tendered instructions, and that constitutes reversible error because there was no other option available to the jury once that ruling had been entered and no instructions were given. The jury was only offered the option, if you will, of attempted secondary murder, the prosecution's theory.
And weren't there lesser included offenses? There was that option.
At the first trial, it was charged as attempted first degree murder. The lesser included was attempted second degree murder. At the second trial, as I understand it, I have the instructions, I can look, but I believe it was just attempted second degree murder. It might have included attempted reckless, but I don't believe that's the case. I can check.
The record shows that there was a first degree assault, second degree assault, and third degree assault lesser included instructions given in the second trial.
Well, if that's true, that doesn't, if we're talking about the shooting of the shotgun at the driver of the truck, the defendant's theory was comprised of the actual shooting of that particular gun and its discharge. And the lesser non-included basically addressed that particular issue. The Trujillo case in the Supreme Court, the court addressed the defendant's argument and held that there was not a problem with the refusal of the tendered lesser nons at the second trial because the trial court had, in fact, instructed on two lesser nons that the defendant had tendered as part of his theory. And so the issue here is the defendant's theory of defense, not so much the charged offenses of first-degree assault or second-degree assault. The question is whether or not his theory was properly comprised within the context of the instructions.
Mr. Herr, doesn't the concept of giving lesser non-included instructions assume that there is a basis, a rational basis, I think is what the cases say, for acquitting on the greater charge and convicting on the lesser? I think that's the law. If so, how can there be a rational basis for convicting on the lesser here when, as a matter of law, the jury could not convict on the lesser here?
Well, I think this raises the state's argument about the question of the effect of the jury's verdict. The issue is not so much whether or not the jury has the right to be knowledgeable of whether or not what effect their verdict is going to have. The question is whether or not the defendant is avail himself of his right to defend himself and offer his theory.
But when do we ever give the jury the right to decide hypothetical questions?
Well, I don't think it's hypothetical. In this particular case, the litigation of his culpability is not a hypothetical. And so in this particular case, in his second trial, that was not a hypothetical. And so what was really at stake was his liberty interests, and his theory was not offered. If I can move to the in terms of hypothetical, the Trujillo court mentions looking to the arguments of counsel in terms of really assessing prejudice, I believe. And the court says, well, there's really no fundamental difference between what counsel argued at the first trial and the second trial, given that this, at the second trial, the court offered these two other lesser non-included offenses, as well as the affirmative defense of self-defense. So in essence, there was no difference, no distinction drawn by defense counsel in terms of how they argued the case or how the defense proceeded. In this particular case, if the court looks at the first trial and the closing argument, it's at it's on the CD at, on 10-24-07. Counsel takes several pages to address the comparison between the lesser non-includeds as his defense and the charge offenses, which included attempted first-degree murder, and she also mentions attempted second-degree murder. And so in terms of assessing the prejudice at the second trial, counsel was unable to talk about that. If you look at the closing argument, no argument can be made about assessing and comparing the relative culpability of Mr. Wartina, the prosecution's theory versus the defense theory.
Because wasn't he permitted to argue, though, that the prosecution had overcharged in the second trial? And wasn't he also permitted to say, and didn't he in fact say, defense counsel say, if this fits anything, it's criminally negligent assault?
I don't know about criminally negligent assault. I know that the court did rule that the defense could argue that the prosecution could have charged other offenses. But that doesn't comprise what the due process issue is about. The due process issue is about giving the jury the actual option. They have to have the alternative to enter a verdict, to say this is what he is in fact culpable of. To be able to argue it is really, it's no alternative. It's simply saying, we believe the executive branch should have done this or that.
Isn't that the essence of Trujillo, though? Didn't the Supreme Court say, if you can make the argument based on the instructions given, then give the jury the actual option of choosing a different offense than that charge? Isn't that sufficient?
I don't believe it's different, and I would disagree on two levels. One is that other charged offenses by the prosecution comprised his theory. That was not his theory. Secondly, to be able to simply make the argument is not the essence of the due process claim. The Trujillo court talked about the jury having the alternative to enter verdicts, the option, and that's why I stress the alternative, to simply be able to make the argument about some of their offenses that are charged by the prosecution.
Well, then isn't it
not the defense theory?
Okay, isn't it critical then to know whether or not in the second trial, first degree, second degree, and third degree assault were actually instructed on? And I think they were.
I can get the instructions very quickly if you like.
Well, I think that's critical. So if you would, that would be helpful, because I think in my mind the question is, if there was a lesser charge, one or more lesser charges, whether it was non-included or included, the defendant had the ability to say to the jury, choose my option. This is what I'm arguing.
While I'm looking, I think my argument really is that the defense theory is not comprised in other charges that the prosecution brought against my client. And I think that that's borne out. You're correct, Your Honor. It's instruction number 17, and the jury instructions for the second trial involving attempt to commit assaults in the first degree and so forth. And those were comprised within the context of the prosecution's theory. The difference is that the defense theory of defense is comprised in lesser non-includeds, which are involving and are more limited to and more less serious than these particular offenses. To say that a defense theory is only limited to what the prosecution charges and the lesser offenses that the prosecution wishes to obtain, because these can be obtained by the prosecution simply by asking. This is not the defense theory. And it doesn't address the actual conduct that my client committed.
But it doesn't seem that the defense theory is my client is guilty of these lesser included offenses. The defense theory is my client did not have the culpable mental state required for this greater offense. His culpable mental state was something less, and he did not intend to do this. Well, and the other instructions that were given gave the jury the option of considering that very argument. did he have this intent, or did he have some lesser degree of intent? So they considered it and rejected it.
Well, I, 2 points. One is that the lesser included that are comprised within the prosecution's theory involve bodily injury and causing injury to a person. My client's lessers included prohibited use of a weapon, illegal discharge, reckless endangerment, and felony menacing. None of them included having the mens rea that Your Honor's talking about of causing bodily injury. That was not, and that's also consistent with the co-defendant's testimony at the second trial, which was that my client got out of the car to scare the guy. Excuse me. So I think even if Your Honor is correct, that that might be a lesser included mens rea, if you will, of how Mr. Ortina acted, it's still inconsistent with his theory. And again, that theory is the prosecution's theory. These are lesser included that the prosecution can obtain simply by request, which they did, and they are not part of the defense theory. And the defense theory is very different, as I've just described, between a mens rea that's going to cause bodily injury, the greatest of which was the prosecution's theory that he wanted to cause his death, versus the defense theory, which was, I just want to scare the guy, which is what the co-defendant testified to. They brought the co-defendant in, and that's what he testified to. And that's even stronger than the first trial, in which he actually got these lesser nods, and the jury actually convicted him of those. So I hope that addresses the court's concern about Instruction 17 and those lessers. Regarding the arguments, I think I want to briefly touch on those.
Off this issue, I'm also a little troubled, and I know this gets into the double jeopardy issue, but it seems to me your client wanted to waive double jeopardy for purposes of instructing the jury, but then in the event that the jury came back with verdicts, say, never mind, I'm not waiving. What's the legal authority for a defendant's ability to retract a waiver like that?
Well, I think as I described, double jeopardy involves three potential protections. One is a subsequent prosecution after an acquittal, subsequent prosecution after a conviction, and then the prospect of multiple sentences or consecutive sentencing for the same crime. In this particular case, Mr. Ortina was saying, look, I'm waiving my right to be re-prosecuted after conviction for these same crimes. The second part of this, which is really, I think, the third prong, involves what would happen should the jury convict again of those lesser nods in conformity with his theory or consistent with his theory. And the answer to that is really something that would be worked out with the parties in the court at sentencing. But it doesn't affect his ability to waive double jeopardy. Really, he's waiving one constitutional right, double jeopardy, to assert another, which is his due process right to defend himself and have his theory of defense properly presented, which is not something that's unusual or an anomaly.
Waiving it, but with a string attached, so he can yank it back. And my question was, is there any legal authority that says that a defendant can do that?
Well, I would disagree that he's going to yank it back because he's, and secondly, that he's yanking it back or would seek to avoid potential implications of having been re-prosecuted following conviction. He's waived that. He said he did and would. I think it's the third issue regarding multiple punishments, which is a sentencing issue. And contrary to the state, I believe that the sentencing issue is not an issue for the jury and it's of no concern. And so I think this kind of gets to your question about hypothetical. It's really of no moment, really, what happens with regard to the ultimate effect of having been convicted, reconvicted, and conforming with his theory. That would be something that the parties would address at sentencing. It's a sentencing issue. Juries in Colorado have nothing to do with sentencing and haven't for decades.
Such as sentencing, the court would be required to set aside the verdict.
Well, that might be the case. But again, it also gets back to in addressing the third prong of double jeopardy protections. Whether that happens or not, it's unclear. Whether it requires simply concurrent sentencing, that's unclear. But it's something that's not yet arisen. He never had the chance, the opportunity to really address. I see I have about 40 seconds left. I'd like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, and may it please the court. John Lee on behalf of the people, bar number 38141. The defendant was seeking and is seeking a rule that would allow the jury the option of convicting him of the four lesser non-included offenses that would have no legal force. Whether this court looks at this issue from the perspective of double jeopardy, general law regarding jury instructions, or res judicata, to me, the end result is the same. The trial court correctly rejected to give the defendants four lesser non-included instructions. To begin, I want to begin with, I think, which is the premise to Mr. Hare's argument, and that is that a defendant has a due process right to receive a lesser not included offense. More precisely, his argument is, I believe, that whatever legal principles may prohibit a jury from considering lesser not included offenses, his due process right trumps over that. But as this court explained in Rubio, a critical feature of lesser not included offenses is they're not required by federal or state constitutions. They're not required by statute. They're not required by court rule. Their only source, their only authorizing source is case law. And case law has never said that a defendant must get a lesser not included offense because due process requires it.
Well, I think what Mr. Hare is saying is that these instructions on lesser non-includeds embodied his theory of defense. And a defendant is entitled to instructions on his theory of defense as a matter of constitutional right.
He is. And I would point, the only case, at least in the briefs, that has ever said that a defendant's right to have the jury actually make a finding on a lesser non-included offense is Skinner, where lesser non-included come from is Rivera, and what Rivera said was a defendant has a right to have a lesser non-included offense in conjunction with a theory of defense. It is not in place of his theory of defense. It just goes along with the theory of defense.
So here the theory of defense is I just intended to scare the driver of the other vehicle, and those lesser non-included fit that. Do they really fit the lesser included? Because they require an intent to cause bodily injury.
It depends on how broadly we define the right. So I think today I heard defense counsel say that the purpose of lesser non-included is just options. So if that's what it is, then yes, the lesser included did cover that issue. If you're just giving the jury an option of convicting the defendant of something else, of course the lesser included would fit that categorization. If the concept is more closely to what the Supreme Court said in Rivera, which is we allow the lesser non-included for the jury to consider whether the defendant was overcharged so that they have a better idea, so we can verify, just because it's more certain that the people proved each and every element of the greater, then I think the court's other instructions in this case certainly covered that. They said that we had to prove each and every element. So I think from either perspective of what lesser non-included means, whether what defense counsel is saying today or whether what Supreme Court said in Rivera, I think they're absolutely encompassed within the court's instructions. I also like to make the point that even if it was not covered in the instructions, because this is an issue that is authorized only by case law, I have not found a case where it has ever gone as far as the defense wants to push it in this case. We have, I think, many legal principles which would prohibit a jury from considering it. So in order for the defendant to win in this case, this court would need to say not only that the defendant has a right to lesser non-included, but in such a way that it trumps over other legal principles, in particular, double jeopardy, case in controversy, and correct jury instructions. I think as Judge Jones pointed out, there is no authority for the defense proposition that a defendant can waive just part of his double jeopardy rights. In this case, I mean, the waiver, as I understand it, wasn't a waiver at all. But even if a defendant could, we still run into the problem that it's an incorrect instruction of law. The instruction the defendant wanted was to tell the jury that they could convict the defendant of the four lesser not includeds, when in fact it's undisputed that they couldn't. It's a general rule of law that we don't instruct the jury with wrong instructions. And in that sense, this would have been a wrong instruction. Additionally, I think we also run into the problem of case and controversy. We don't let the fact finders consider issues that aren't actually at issue. In this case, the jury could not convict the defendant of the four lesser non-includeds. So I think on that ground, it was inappropriate to allow them to consider the four lesser non-includeds. And even assuming that those other principles didn't prohibit the jury from getting the instructions, I still think that res judicata would control this case. All the elements are met. And as our Supreme Court has explained, there's two main principles behind it: judicial economy and judicial integrity. Judicial economy is not at issue here, but I certainly think judicial integrity is.
Res judicata is a little bit difficult for your side in this case, because that's the kind of defense that you would think the defendant would raise here. I'm not familiar with res judicata being used in the way that you're proposing. That, you know, res judicata is when a defendant says, you can't sue me for this, you've already sued me for it, or something like that. In this context, you can't charge me with this, you already charged me with that, and I've been convicted of it. He's not saying that. He's willing to say, I don't care, I waive that. It's odd coming from your side that you're trying to invoke this res judicata, or kind of force him to into this res judicata box if he doesn't want it.
I would agree that it is unusual in the context of how we normally apply it, but I do think the elements fit. I mean, the elements are, and it certainly fits with the purpose. The elements of res judicata just are the issues the same? Are the parties the same? Did the parties have a full interest in the prior proceeding? And did they reach a verdict? With the purpose being, one of the main purposes being, is we don't want two different factual findings because it undermines the integrity of the judicial system.
In the context of lesser non-included, we have a situation where things are tipped toward the defendant in the sense that the prosecution can't have a lesser non-included charge to the jury unless the defendant consents. And if the defendant wants such a charge, he gets it so long as there's some evidence to support it. So it's kind of an unequal playing field tipped in favor of the defendant there. And then given that, why should the prosecution be allowed to step in and say res judicata? I mean, the prosecution has no control over whether these kinds of charges are asserted at this point in the trial.
My response would be, I don't think res judicata is, it's not really a tool for the litigants. It's more built into the system itself. We want to maintain judicial integrity as best we can, and that's why we don't have judicial fact finders consider the same issue and potentially reach inconsistent results when those four elements are present. And I think they certainly are present in this case. And if the court has no further questions, I would ask the court to affirm the judgment of the court below. Thank you very much.
May it please the court. With regard to res judicata, the essential principle is to bar relitigation. And the prosecution, really, the greater issue here is the prosecution is relitigating Mr. Guartina's culpability. And ultimately, it gets down to, does Mr. Guartina have the right to defend himself with his theory about what he's culpable of in the litigation of his culpability on that particular night? With regard to case and controversy, again, it's the prosecution re-prosecuting the case and controversy regarding his culpability. Mr. Guartina has the right to defend himself and offer the jury his theory. That's his theory that is not involved in injuring, as we've discussed, the particular victim in this case. And the question ultimately is, can they acquit of the prosecution's theory and enter verdicts consistent with regard to what Mr. Guartina's theory is? And I see my time has expired, and I ask the court, for the foregoing reasons, to vacate the second-degree burglary conviction and to reverse and remand on the attempted second-degree murder conviction.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you for your arguments this morning. This case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.